had a series of interesting scenic days out.
Yes.
We went to one of the few advantages of a global pandemic is you can go to places in August, provided you book in advance, and there isn't anyone there because they have, it's not an advantage for them. But we went, for instance, we went to Great Dixter.
Brilliant.
In Sussex, Christopher Lloyd's garden.
Amazing.
In full bloom with about 10 other people there. It was absolutely beautiful.
It's spectacular, isn't it?
And we went to Farley's house near Lewes, which is where Roland Penrose and Lee Miller lived.
Amazing.
The house itself isn't open, but the gardens and the gallery space is open. Shani, where are you?
So I'm in Vicenza in the Veneto, northern Italy.
And you've been in Umbria.
I've been in Umbria and just drove up today. Italy is strange because August is a big holiday month. It's just Ferragosto, so a lot of families on the move. We did a day trip in Tuscany to see some friends in San Gimignano. It was packed. So that whole thing of the tourists are not coming, I'm not sure, because I think they are coming in August. And maybe it's not to the scale at which it usually is, but it's busy because I think Italians are on the move in Italy.
Mm.
But yeah, now I'm back in Vicenza. I can see the little Dolomites outside the window, and it's different.
Lovely, lovely.
Yeah.
So you don't know when you're going to get back to Tamil Nadu?
No, I'd like to go in maybe October, end of October, but the cases are still rising in India and the flights have been restricted so far. So I think it's best if I stay put and monitor the situation.
I worry about your dogs.
There's someone there to look after them.
As long as the dogs
are there. I worry about them too, though. Yeah.
Have you got a hotline? Have you got someone on FaceTime showing you your dogs?
No, she doesn't have a smartphone, but my parents have been able to go and friends have started to go because they've also been closing down districts. So from the city to get out there, it hasn't been easy, but now they've been able to go. So I've had firsthand reports and photographs. They're healthy and alive. So.
always a good way for a dog to be.
Absolutely.
Right. Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today you find us in 14th century Kashmir, a land of lakes, rivers, snow-capped mountains and lush gardens full of jasmine, saffron and narcissus. We're waiting by the side of a river for a ferry to arrive. We hear a woman chanting. We have wine, meat and cake fit for the gods. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today, as you will have heard, is the poet, novelist and dancer Tashani Doshi. Hello.
Hi there. Hi.
Right. Her most recent books are Girls Are Coming Out of the Woods, which was published in the UK in 2017 by Blood Axe Books, and which was shortlisted for the Ted Hughes Award. And a novel, Small Days and Nights, which, John, you talked about on this podcast on episode 91.
Daniel Defoe. A strange place for it to crop up, but that's where it was.
Small Days and Nights, which was published by Bloomsbury and shortlisted for the RSL Ondaatje Prize. Tashani worked for 15 years as the lead dancer with the Chandralekha Group in Madras, India, a contemporary dance company using Indian forms. Born to a Welsh mother and a Gujarati father, she now lives mostly on a beach in Tamil Nadu, but spends a fair bit of time wandering. She is a visiting professor of creative writing at New York University in Abu Dhabi and has a new book of poems out with Blood Axe in spring next year. That right?
Yep.
Spring 2021, A God at the Door. Have you finished it?
Yes, I have. I'm still
congratulations.
I'm adding a few poems here and there, but it's mostly done, yeah.
Okay.
Wonderful. And a title sort of feels very, very, very appropriate for what we're about to talk about. The book that Tashani's chosen is I, Lala, The Poems of Lal Ded, a collection of poems by the 14th century female mystic known variously as Lala, Lal Ded, Lala Shwari, or Lal Arifa, and specifically in the modern translation by the Indian poet Ranjit Hoskote, published as a Penguin Classic in 2013. This edition collects 146 of Lala's short, vivid, spiritually intense poems, which, as Andy rather wisely pointed out earlier this week, are quick to read, but take a lifetime or more to fully understand.
Lifetimes, probably.
Lifetimes, yes. Anyway, before we travel back in time and space, I'm going to ask Andy the inevitable question. What have you been reading this week?
Right. So the first thing I want to talk about is a book called Restaging the Past, Historical Pageants, Culture and Society in Modern Britain. And that's published by UCL Press. And the two reasons I want to mention that are, one, anyone who follows this podcast this year will know I have been reading about pageants. I'm fascinated by the 30s and 40s phenomenon in Britain of the pageant. And as if by magic, last week, somebody sent me a link to this book, Restaging the Past. And the second reason I want to talk about it, I haven't even read it yet. It's free. You can buy a copy as a hardback or a paperback. But if you want the PDF, the people who've written the book made a deal with UCL Press that, in keeping with the spirit of pageants, you can download it for nothing. It's 300 pages long.
How brilliant.
It contains essays called things like Historical Pageants Before the First World War and History, Community and Local Identity in the 1951 Festival of Britain.
Great.
If that sounds like your sort of thing, and goodness knows it sounds like mine, go straight to historicalpageants.ac.uk, and that has 1.5 million words on the subject of historical pageants in the UK in the 20th century.
So this is a free book you haven't read that's available from the internet, which we'll put the link on the website as well.
We
if
will.
People didn't get so. That's what you haven't been reading this week.
That's what I haven't been reading this week. I have been reading in what has become a backlisted tradition, the new novel by Ali Smith, which is called Summer, the fourth part of her seasonal quartet. I talked about Autumn on episode 24 in October 2016, which was devoted to Robert Aikman. For some reason, I didn't talk about Winter. And I also talked about Spring last year, April last year, on episode 90, which was devoted to Great Expectations. So it feels right that I should say something about Summer. I'm just going to read, as I think I did on the previous occasion, I'm just going to read the opening of the book. And as we've said on this podcast before, the wonderful thing about these books has been Ali Smith's attempt to make them as contemporary as she can, and the willingness of everyone at her publisher to enable that. And if you listen to Backlisted, you probably are a bit of a publishing and book nerd. You will thoroughly enjoy a piece by Alice Vincent on Penguin's website, which is an oral history of how they publish these books, talking to Ali Smith and her editor, Simon Prosser, but everyone else who worked on them. Marketing department, publicity department, the cover designer, the person who had to get permission to use the Hockney prints that they've put on the cover, the sales team who had to go out and sell them with no real material to work on. If you are fascinated about how they made this happen so stylishly and so confidently and so critically successfully and so commercially successfully, I found it completely fascinating. This has been my favourite publishing project of the last few years. So this is how this book begins, and as Ali Smith has done in previous volumes, it's sort of like almost like her talking to you before you start reading the book. Everybody said, so? As in, so what? As in, shoulder shrug, or what do you expect me to do about it? Or, I don't really give a fuck, or actually I approve of it, it's fine by me. Okay, not everybody said it. I'm speaking colloquially, like in that phrase, everybody's doing it. What I mean is, it was a clear marker just then of that particular time, a kind of litmus, this dismissive note. It got fashionable around then to act like you didn't care. It got fashionable to insist the people who did care or said they cared were either hopeless losers or were just showing off. It's like a lifetime ago. But it isn't. It's literally only a few months since a time when people who lived in this country all their lives or most of their lives started to get arrested and threatened with deportation or deported. So? And when a government shut down its own parliament because it couldn't get the result it wanted. So? When so many people voted people into power who looked them straight in the eye and lied to them. So? When a continent burned and another melted. So? when people in power across the world started picking off groups of people by religion, ethnicity, sexuality, intellectual or political descent. So, but no, true, not everybody said it. Not by a country mile. Millions of people didn't say it. Millions and millions all across the country and all across the world saw the lying and the mistreatments of people and the planet and were vocal about it on marches, in protests, by writing, by voting, by talking, by activism on the radio, on TV, via social media, tweet after tweet, page after page, to which people who knew the power of saying so said on the radio, on TV, via social media, tweet after tweet, page after page. So, I mean, I could spend my whole life listing things about and talking about and demonstrating with sources and graphs and examples and statistics what history's made it clear happens when we're indifferent and what the consequences are of the political cultivation of indifference, which whoever wants to disavow will dismiss in an instant with their own punchy little so. Instead, here's something I once saw. It's an image from a film made in the UK roughly 70 years ago, not long after the end of the Second World War. The film was made in London by a young artist who arrived in the city from Italy when London was one of the many places having to rebuild themselves in those years nearly a lifetime ago, after the tens of millions of people of all ages all across the world had died before their time. It's an image of a man carrying two suitcases. He's a slight man, a young man, a distracted and tentative kind of a man, dapper in a hat and jacket, light on his feet, but at the same time burdened. It's clear he'd be burdened even if he wasn't carrying two suitcases. He is grave, slim, preoccupied, terribly keen, and he is silhouetted against the sky because he's balanced on a very narrow brick ledge which runs around the edge of a high building, along the length of which he's doing a joyous and frantic dance with the beaten-up rooftops of London behind him. No, more precisely, those roofs are way below him. How can he be going so fast and not fall off the edge of the building? How can what he's doing be so wild and still so graceful, so urgent and blithe both at once? How can he be swinging those cases around in the air like that and still keep his balance? How can he be moving at such speed next to the sheer drop? Why is he risking everything? There'd be no point in showing you a still or a photo of this. It's very much a moving image. For several seconds, he does a crazed but merry high-wire dance above the city, going far too fast along the zigzagging path of a ledge that's the width of a single brick. So, and that's the start of the book. And the so ends there with a colon, as if to say, here's my answer to the question I've just posed. Ali Smith dancing on a narrow ledge. Wonderful. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I cannot wait to have the opportunity when things have calmed down to read all four books again. John,
marvelous.
What have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a absolutely, I think, brilliant, kind of gripping, turbocharged novel by a young Mexican writer called Fernanda Melchor. The book's called Hurricane Season, set in contemporary Mexico in Veracruz. It's set in a village, an imaginary village. It's really hard to describe this book without it making it sound unbelievably grim. It's about femicide. You know, there is sort of 10 women per day murdered in Mexico. 98% of them are of those murders are never solved. What Melchor has done, it's a book, an incredibly angry book, but it's so brilliantly written, and I have to say, magnificently translated by Sophie Hughes. It's published by Fitzcarraldo, and Sophie Hughes' translation, slangy translation, is wonderful. It's divided into 8 chapters, which each of which is a kind of Rashomon-like attempt to show the murder of an old woman known as the Witch. The Witch lives in this really kind of grimy, disgusting house where she performs abortions, she sells drugs, she has sex with younger men, she has a sort of a coterie of gay men who go and spend time with her. And the book is really about the young people, some men, some women. There's a 13-year-old girl who's pregnant by her stepfather. There's a young guy who's her who's her husband or wants to marry her anyway. Each of their stories is told through that through their own perspective in a kind of torrent of language. I read it, you know, kind of huge gulps because you really do want to know what happens. You do want to solve the mystery of how the witch at the beginning of the book is found floating in a disgusting stream. Her corpse is found, you know, with black snakes kind of eating away at her face. It's pretty grim. It's a book about misogyny. It's a book about how young people's dreams are corrupted by large corporations. It's a book about love all the way through. It's shot through with passages of incredible beauty and tenderness and loveliness. The characters in it, this is a long way from the kind of narco sort of carnival that you get a lot of presentations of contemporary Mexico. This is real. Mm. This is poor people's real lives. The thing I kept thinking of was Acatone, the great Pasolini film. Mm-hmm. An attempt to show real people's lives in a real way. M. John Harrison, Mike Harrison reviewed it, and he said something that really chimed with me. He said, you kind of end it feeling elated, even though you've had all of this terrible stuff. It was based on a real murder. It's based on a real murder of a real woman. She's done what only a novelist can do, or maybe a poet can do, and looked into the heart of what's going on.
I saw Chris Power, our former guest, Chris Power, who was raving about it as well.
It's like driving off a cliff, this book, without a handbrake on. I'm going to read you just a little bit, just to give you the flavour. This is from towards the end. I mean, you can't really break into the narrative flow, but it gives you a bit of the feeling of the book. And I'll spare you some of the worst. I mean, if you want grimy details about the way men's minds work, the way men relate to pornography, there's so much detail in this book, probably more than anything I've read.
But thanks.
They say the place is hot, that it won't be long before they send in the Marines to restore order in the region. They say the heat's driven the locals crazy, that it's not normal, May and not a single drop of rain, and that the hurricane season's coming hard, and it must be bad vibes, jinxes, causing all that bleakness. Decapitated bodies, maimed bodies, rolled up, bagged up bodies, dumped on the roadside or in hastily dug graves on the outskirts of town. Men killed in shootouts and car crashes and revenge killings between rival clans. Rapes, suicides, crimes of passion, as the journalists call them. They say that's why the women are on edge, especially in La Matosa. They say that come evening, they gather on their porches to smoke filterless cigarettes and cradle their youngest babes in their arms, blowing their peppery breath over these tender crowns to shoo away the mosquitoes, basking in what little breeze reaches them from the river, when at last the town settles into silence and you can just about make out the music coming from the highway brothels in the distance, the rumble of the trucks as they make their way to the oil fields, the baying of dogs calling each other like wolves from one side of the plain to the other. The time of the evening when the women sit around telling stories with one eye on the sky, looking out for that strange white bird that perches on the tallest tree and watches them with a look that seems to want to tell them something, that they mustn't go inside the witch's house, probably, that they mustn't walk past or peek through the yawning holes that now mark its walls. A look warning them not to let their children go looking for that treasure, not to dream of going down there with their friends to rummage through those tumble-down rooms, or to see who's got the balls to enter the rooms upstairs at the back and touch the stain left by the witch's corpse on the filthy mattress. To tell their children how others have run screaming from that place, faint from the stench that lingers inside, terror-stricken by the vision of a shadow that peels itself off the walls and chases you out of there. To respect the dead silence of that house, the pain of the miserable souls who once lived there. That's what the women in town say. There is no treasure in there, no gold or silver or diamonds or anything more than a searing pain that refuses to go away.
Oof.
Oof. Yeah, brilliant. I mean, as I say, weird, but I really, really, really enjoyed it.
It's in shops now. It's published by Fitzcarraldo.
It's published by Fitzcarraldo. It was on the International Booker shortlist for the International Booker Prize. And she's going to write other great books. Mm-hmm. Really, really exciting to discover.
Now it's commercials.
Why did you choose this particular book?
So the first thing was that I wanted to give the two of you a real challenge.
Challenge accepted.
I saw the books that you've talked about, and I thought this would be something very much out of your normal range. And also, It happens to be the book that I am reading. And when people ask you, you know, the book that changed your life, or I always feel like the book that's changing your life is the book that you're reading at the moment. And so for me, this is a book that's sort of been keeping me company for the last few months. And I just thought, you know, here's a woman who existed 700 years ago. We know very little about her. The first time her name comes into print is in 1920. So these poems of hers have stuck around in different forms and shapes, and they remain. Also, she's a woman. So that was interesting to me and important to me in a way, because I feel that so many voices of women have been suppressed historically. So drawing them out. And finally, you know, she's a Kashmiri mystic. And I feel, in a sense, what's going on now in Kashmir and has been going on has been, so difficult, I think, for so many Indians and for Kashmiris themselves. And Lala represents a kind of wonderful synthesis and syncretism, which seems to have been lost now in our whole country. And so in a way, she's offering something hopeful, you know. So I think that's why I chose her, because I feel strongly that poetry has transformative powers and that poets can speak to us from across time. And I definitely felt when I was reading these in lockdown in Abu Dhabi that she was speaking directly in my ear, you know. And so that's why I thought, why not get the two of you who come from very different backgrounds to see what you felt about these poems and about her.
I find that really interesting, because of course one of the things about this I realized when I was reading up about it is she's from Kashmir, and you know, her poetry represents what Kashmir was for many centuries, doesn't it? It's a pluralist. Yeah. It isn't one particular form of spirituality that's being expressed. It's a kind of pluralist poetry coming out of a pluralist region, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was Hindu. She was a seeker. She practiced tantric Shaivism. She knew the Yogacharas. She knew Mahayana Buddhism. She used elements of Sufism. And she's claimed by everybody, you know. And I think that's also interesting how different religious groups and constitutions say that she's ours. So she speaks to a wide variety of people.
It's some of the earliest work in the Kashmiri language, which is interesting. But she kind of invents a poetic form at the same time that the Vak, which roughly translates as sort of saying. They're almost haiku-like in their kind of intensity. And as I think I said at the beginning, there's a canon of Vaks that get attributed to her. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty certain that not all of them were probably written by one historical person. And one of the, I think, brilliant things that Ranjit Hotsoke does in his book is he talks about it as being like open software, that she creates a form that people are able over various centuries to add to, which kind of is a completely different way of thinking about this is just one person's historical experience.
Absolutely.
It's a way of looking at the world.
Yeah, and Hoskote talks about how it goes from oral to scribal to written, and how it's not about Lal Dev who composed these poems, but the Lal Dev who emerges from these poems. So the idea that this is a group act over centuries, that, you know, people are adding their own bits. And so in a way, the individual is not so important, individual authorship, you know. We are attributing this to this mystic poet, but it's certainly like, it's a kind of palimpsest, you know, of time, of ideas, of personalities. Mm. So I just think it's very interesting given the cultural moment that we're living in, where we place so much of the idea on the individual and authorship and, you know, this is my idea or your idea.
Yeah. I was thinking different tradition, but it reminded me a little bit. A couple of years ago, I read the whole of the Book of Psalms in one go and was reading it. And you realize that there's probably not going to be single authorship either, but there is a thing about what feels like an individual lyric experience of suffering, of exile, of pain, of difficulty. Everybody can find their way of relating to it. And that's what I've sort of felt here, is that although these are much more, I really love them, they're really flavoursome and strong and a bit less whingy than I think the Psalms.
Wow. The guys who wrote the Psalms are sobbing into their palm leaves now.
Well, they're certainly shorter.
Yeah.
So, Shani, before you read us a couple of examples, maybe, had you just read this version for the first time? You know, can you remember when you first became aware of this poetry, this philosophy?
I can't actually. I had met Ranjith when we did a Dylan Thomas kind of poetry thing some years ago in Wales, and he was telling me about this project. And I think it's been a huge 20-year project for him. And I'd read some of these books isolated, but this was the first time that I read them in entirety. And I think sometimes it's that thing with a book that you've had sitting on your shelf that you haven't read, and then suddenly you need it for some reason and you intuitively pick that book that you need to read.
I don't think anyone should hear any of these poems in the voice of me or John Mitchinson first. So I've got some here. Look, there's a bit of paper. I wrote down the ones that really spoke to me, right? There. So I've got these good to go, but I think we want to hear from you first. So please share a couple with us.
Okay. So I'll read Vak 52. I trapped my breath in the bellows of my throat. A lamp blazed up inside, showed me who I really was. I crossed the darkness, holding fast to that lamp, scattering its light seeds around me as I went. And this is number 14. I wore myself out looking for myself. No one could have worked harder to break the code. I lost myself in myself and found a wine cellar. Nectar, I tell you, there were jars and jars of the good stuff and no one to drink it.
Could I just say, on my bit of paper, number 14 was the first one there. So you've gazumped me on number 14. Could you tell us a bit about why those two spoke to you particularly?
Well, the first one about breath, and I wanted to read a poem of my own, which relates in a completely different way. But it's obviously about like a kind of awakening or clearing of the path or finding one's way in the world and understanding that somehow this has to do with knowing of oneself. So it's really about this inward journey. I wore myself out looking for myself, you know. And how that idea of, if you want to think of any sense of divinity, is actually not in a temple or a church or in some place that you go to, but you carry it within yourself, inside yourself. You know, and I love that it's something sensual like wine, that it's nectar. It's full of joy, this, to me, in a way that I think sometimes when we look at religious interpretation, they just take the joy factor out, the celebration. And I think these poems and a lot of the other ones that I chose are about that, you know, that sense of joyfulness of self and searching.
She likes a swerve. That's what I like. And number 14 has that going on there. So it starts, I wore myself out looking for myself. What a beautiful and brilliant line that is, right?
It's so great, isn't it?
No one could have worked harder to break the code. That really reminded me of a line by Jean Rhys, a novelist I really love.
Oh, yeah.
I know I don't succeed, but look how hard I try.
Yeah.
the great, you know, wonderful, wonderful line.
Yeah.
I lost myself in myself and found a wine cellar. Now, you said, I see the wine cellar image there. I'm drinking a glass of wine here. There's the imbibing. You know, it's not just nectar. It's going to obscure consciousness. It's not going to reveal consciousness. Nectar, I tell you, there were jars and jars of the good stuff, and here's the swerve, and no one to drink it.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful, so right? There's the pause before the end of the vac where she allows you to stop and think and say, well, what does that mean? What, there's so much space in four lines in so many of these for the reader to find what they want to find. I found it really, like John says, you know, thank you for pushing us into a different area, for taking us out of our comfort zones. Because this is the kind of writing that you have to read differently. Right, Mitch?
Yeah, I think. And I think while there are, you know, there are kind of all the time, I was struck by, you know, a couple of times I was thinking, my God, this is like a Bob Dylan song. It's just a list. She does wonderful lists.
For much shorter.
Yeah, but... And it's just the directness as well. I love this one. Don't think I did all this to get famous.
Mm.
I never cared for the good things of life. I always ate sensibly. I knew hunger well and sorrow and God. It's just, there's such simplicity in that. And sort of, and you have to say, wisdom, hard-won wisdom always in this stuff.
Yes, I'd like it to be noted that I read, again, I owe you a debt of thanks, because I read this book more times than any book I've ever had to read for that.
Me too. I found the Bob Dylan one.
Oh, let's hear it. Come on.
I saw a sage starving to death. No, I won't do it in the Bob Dylan voice. I saw a sage starving to death, a leaf floating to earth on a winter breeze. I saw a fool beating his crook. And now I'm waiting for someone to cut the love cord that keeps me tied to this crazy world.
Yeah.
I know you're going to read some of your own poetry, and we would absolutely love to hear that. I think that certainly if it's a response or it was inspired by either of the vocs we've just heard, that would be great.
Okay. I'll read a short poem called Cosmos.
Yes, it's coming together.
It's
the
all
plan's
coming together.
Together.
Yeah, and these were sort of six short poems that I wrote for Granta recently, and it was exploring the idea of membranes. And so it starts with the cell, and it moves out to larger and larger containers, you know, nation, collective, and then it ends with the cosmos. So this is Cosmos. Each night, I take my boat out to you, asleep under the oaks. I thought I saw a lotus creep out of your navel, which means you got my cable. Remember when we were young and the end was a black hole at the edge of forever, a million light years away? Now we're in the thick of it. See how it swallows everything. A jungle leopard feasting through our bloodline of mongrels. Have you noticed, lying there as you do in moonlight, how a hurricane viewed from outer space looks like a wisp of cotton candy, or how the seagull nebula resembles a section of rosy duodenum. Down in the market, a man speaks of finding anger in his left armpit. Another talks of space debris drifting into the river Lethe. No one can tell me why we paint demons on our houses, except it has to do with entries and exits. The monsters are never far away. I want to believe the earth is a single breathing organism. I want to keep going with this bronze body of mine, turning and turning the gears. You left no note, so I must assume you woke in the middle of a dream and took shelter in the forest. Maybe you're already in the beauty of that other world, growing planetary rings and gardens of foxglove. You know this skin is a thin partition, citrus and bergamot sealed in. It is always ourselves we're most afraid of. Take this vellum and pin it to your bodice. Let it say, we were here.
Was that poem written? It's got such a flavour of Lala in it. Was it? Did it grow out of your reading of it, or is it just that you're in the same strange headspace?
I think it's in the same strange headspace because I think I probably wrote it earlier, but it comes out actually of an idea that I learned as a dancer, which is what Chandralekha, my teacher, taught me this sort of saying that. Your body is your universe, and within it, it contains rivers and mountains, and everything that's in the world is within the body. And so if you can harness that, then you can access the larger world, you know? And so there's always been, I think in multiple traditions in India, this idea of the body as microcosm of the universe. So this sense of you carrying around a mini universe within you. So that's why the sense of perspective of what the hurricane looks like from outer space or the bit of duodenum, you know, in the body. This changing of the lens of the microscope and sort of the tunneling out and the tunneling in. And I think why Lala really appeals to me is because for her, the body is exactly this site of experimentation or divinity, but also play and questioning. Also where she's sort of discarding it in a way that it's left for jungle crows or, yes, you know, so yeah, this yeah. sense of body as vehicle, but also while you have it, treating it with a sense of, I don't know if divinity is the right word, but the fact that this is your vehicle to access things or to move through the world, you know?
I've got number 41 here, which seems relevant to that. Mm-hmm. Fool, you won't find your way out by praying from a book.
Yeah.
That seems appropriate to back.
I knew you'd pick this one.
Fool, you won't find your way out by praying from a book. The perfume on a carcass won't give you a clue. Focus on the self. That's the best advice you can get. Hoskote's project here is to take the original texts and render them in a way that feels colloquial, not like verse. They don't feel like verse, do they? It's impossible for me to say because I can't read the original, but I don't know how much formality there is in the original. But these feel to me like not loose translations, but colloquial translations. Is that colloquialism something that you find in the original, do you think?
I don't know because I haven't read other translations, but I think definitely reading his sort of preface, that sense of the fact that she might have said these things in response to a question or to somebody asking, you know, someone asks a question, she answers. So it's not like someone sitting down and crafting a poem and getting everything, you know right. what I mean? It is oral. And for many years it was in the form of sayings or you know, almost proverbs and little poems, you know, these utterances, what he says.
Would it have been sung? Would these have been sung? I know they have been set to music. I mean, I was interested in that sort of oral tradition where the recitation and song, some of them do seem to have a music to them.
I would imagine so. And so I think what he says is that he wanted to resist that poeticizing when people say that, which I think, you know, that sense of making it overly flowery or what maybe some of the earlier translators or orientalizing it or, you know, to go away from that and to bring it as much into the now as possible.
I've got an example here, which is very instructive.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the most contemporary version by Hoskote and he's put it forth in the sequence. Mm-hmm. So I just read you his version first. I'm towing my boat across the ocean with a thread. Will he hear me and help me across? Or am I seeping away like water from a half-baked cup? Wander, my poor soul, you're not going home anytime soon. Okay, so that's the contemporary.
It's very
mix.
It's very appropriate for today.
Yeah. Now, here, from 100 years ago, is the first translation published in English by George Grierson. George Grierson, who was responsible for commissioning the both the publication and the fixing and the translation of these verses. So this is what that sounded like 100 years ago. With a thin rope of untwisted thread, tow I ever my boat o'er the sea. Will God hear the prayers that I have said? Will he safely over carry me? Water in a cup of unbaked clay, whirling and wasting my dizzy soul, slowly is filling to melt away. Oh, how fain would I reach my goal. I mean, the thing is, like, I can see Mitch doing a face palm on
fain,
my monitor.
Just fain. I mean, you know.
But actually, as I read it out loud, I think that's not totally kitsch.
No,
it sounds kitsch to our ears, right?
What?
Tashani, what do you think? I'm not saying, you know, marks out of 10. That's not what I mean. But what's interesting is presenting it in a totally different register to how we might expect to hear it now.
I kind of zoned out. Sorry. No, it's like it gets into this sort of, you know, reciting in school kind of thing. And I just think why these translations are so exciting is because we are talking about language, right, with poetry. And the language has to speak to you. It has to speak to you directly. And I think so... in this sense, there is an advantage to it having been oral. Or, you know, I love the fact that Grierson himself, he got them from somebody who had memorized all these books.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you memorize poetry, you hold it in your body. That's such a beautiful thought. But then, you know, by putting it down and fixing it, we're fixing it to that time when you would say fain to thee and... blah, blah, blah.
Hoskote says that it's a ponderous idiom, is what he says. Part Edwin Arnold, part Leigh Hunt with a dash of Tennyson.
But also within that, there's an element, as he says, of cultural pleading, right? Which is you're trying to present the work slightly over-solicitously as worthy of your attention by dressing it up in this pseudo-respectable language and even versifying it, you know, making it rhyme.
Yeah,
as far as we know, is not the point of the thing. So,
but he also does another thing, I think, in Hoskote's translation, which I like, and he says, you know, he says he's trying to get the jagged epiphanic power of her poetry and to restore the colloquial pulse of her voice.
Yeah,
but he's also trying to retrieve the book, the poetry from what he calls the metaphysical glosses, which is that thing that happens that people get interested in the ideas. They want to know what's the philosophy that these, as though the philosophy and the poetry are sort of different things, and it's like a code to crack. And if you can crack the, but I don't think you need to know much about the background to the historical background to find these poems moving and meaningful, and I mean, I think it adds to that once you do. But I think but in this translation in particular, I think they have a kind of authenticity, which is really.
I found that some landed and some didn't.
Yeah.
Which is what you would expect. That's okay. And you know, the book reads you famously. So, the person I am when I read them without having read the substantive historical matter is different to the person I am after I've read that. So the some of the verses really struck me. Like, I've got number 48 here.
I have that one too, yeah.
Yeah, right. Everyone listening to this has their own podcast, so they'll appreciate this.
I also have it, but it's brilliant.
Do you? We've all chosen it. Tashani, why don't you read it?
Yeah.
But I haven't written it down like you have, so hold on. I have to find it. 48, here we go. I didn't believe in it for a moment, but I gulped down the wine of my own voice, and then I wrestled with the darkness inside me, knocked it down, clawed at it, ripped it to shreds.
I thought this was brilliant. I mean, John and Nikki will tell you, those are the contortions I go through to try and
every
make this
day.
Podcast every single day.
That's somebody speaking to you from hundreds of years ago. They got you nailed, Andy.
Absolutely, right? I don't believe in it for a moment. I gulped down the wine of my own voice.
Yeah. This particular poem, the wine of your own voice and the wrestling with the darkness and the knocking it and clawing it and ripping it, it's anybody who's ever doubted their own work. It's anybody who's ever, you know, reread a piece that they've written and thought, oh, this is crap. No, you know, and I've got to start again. I've missed it.
It's all writers, basically. It's why
we all wrote it down. But
self-doubt. Hey.
That idea too, I really like what you said about the to and fro. Again, another Christian tradition, you know, that when people ask, you know, Christ or a question, he often answers with other questions.
Yes.
Or sometimes, but there's a 144 a bit earlier where she writes, "You won't find the truth by crossing your legs and holding your breath. Daydreams won't take you through the gateway of release. You can stir as much salt as you like in water. It won't become the sea." Again, that's that great swerve at the end.
I love that line. Mm.
I love her directness, which she's saying, you know, that the whole, and that's a theme, isn't it, throughout, that religious extremism, you know, punishing your body, you know, "I prayed so hard my tongue got stuck to my palate," that kind of punishing your body, is that's not the way, you know, that's not going to get you to cosmic consciousness.
You know, cosmic consciousness, again, I like to say that Tishana, you wanted to take us out of our comfort zone, but at the same time, you've done this, you've showed the weirdness of you choosing
it's
this
so
particular
weird.
Thing, right? John and I were saying this is
so
peculiar. Like we've been like this year on Backlisted. We had a few months off, and then since we've come back, it's like been a backlisted spiritual crash course. 2020. We've done a series of books, or we found a series of things that seem to speak to one another.
Yeah.
And I think we were probably both bringing that, and the listeners will be bringing that to this particular text. So we were talking earlier about William James, and William James had been informed by our reading prior to that of J.D. Salinger. And I actually saw a lot of Salinger in this, because Salinger, as we discussed on this podcast, is a spiritual pluralist. Mm. You know, he's somebody,
he's a seeker and a social rebel.
There's also Vak, which is very close to the ending of Zooey from Franny and Zooey.
Mm.
Which is related to the idea of it's talking about the, it isn't over to the fat lady sings. And he says, but what you've got to understand is you're the fat lady.
Yeah.
And so is that other person. And so is that other person. You know, God is in everything.
Mm.
And he calls that Christ within that story. But even his deciding to call it Christ is a very counterintuitive swerve there at the end.
Yeah.
Because Salinger, as we know, was interested in Hinduism and in Buddhism and whatever he felt would work for him.
Yeah.
So if you'd asked us to read, I guess what I'm trying to say, and what I find incredibly energizing, actually as a reader and worth hanging on to, is you were talking about every book changes you. If you'd asked us to read this a year ago, 3 months ago, it wouldn't have meant the same thing to me then as it does reading it now. And I definitely feel, I don't know what you feel, John, but I feel very, people always say this about books and reading, but I feel enriched by the experience of having read those previous books in a lead up to reading this.
Right.
Also, going back to the lockdown point, I think we've been struggling with what does it mean to be on our own, far more than I think, perhaps because there's so much distraction normally. I think most of us have had more time on our own and left with our own perfumed carcass, was one of the phrases that, you know, with our own bodies and our own thoughts and our own selves. That experience has been, some people have found it very difficult, some people have found it revelatory. But I think that the reading feeds into all that. And as you say, that you're also, you know, part of the thing is, how am I to be in the world? And also, how do I find my way out of it? I suppose it's the big questions. This book is continually posing those big questions, but does it in a way, as I said, which feels very unfamiliar and yet very familiar at the same time. It's unfamiliar because it's a tradition that I've never read in before, and it's familiar because the questions are the same.
Tishani, could you share another of your poems?
Yes, I'm happy to. This is a little bit changing the tone somewhat, but I think it might work for the end of the podcast. It's called The Comeback of Speedos.
I like it.
Bless you.
I've read this one. It's a brilliant poem.
It's very new. And I wrote it actually in response to an article that The Observer had run about how Speedos are making a comeback as a fashion statement. But as you might know, in Italy, they've never gone away. So the poem is in the shape of a Speedo. I'll just show it to you there. It's okay. It makes a Speedo. And so this was a little bit wanting to write in a very short poem to pack in a lot like these bucks. But it's obviously totally different in tone. But anyway, I think it's still inspired. The Comeback of Speedos. I'll keep this brief. I remember the shock of Mr. G's tiger striped trunks at the Madras Gymkhana Club. Nothing to conceal, everything to declare, like a Mills and Boone hero. Shiver of ball and sack, acres of hairy scrub. We could not imagine such freedom for ourselves to slice through chlorinated depths with a little basket of dim sum on display. We were girls. To open our legs was treason. We held our breath. So that idea of breath holding, you know, the idea of yoga. The first vak I read was about the bellows. And when I wrote the poem, I thought, oh, we were girls, we held our breath. That sense of is it sort of not an empowering last line? And then actually, no, because with that comes this exhalation, which is the awakening, the freedom, the exploration of one's own body to, you know, why not inhabit a Speedo like Mr. G's tiger stripe trunks for all of us?
That's beautiful. Brilliant.
Do you know, before we go, I'd just like to... You know, as people know, I'm asked, how do you read so much? A lot. And vac number 111 will be my answer to that from now on.
That's a good one.
So imagine someone's just asked me,
Andy, I just don't get it. How do you read so much?
Well, Nikki, what the books taught me, I've practiced. What they didn't teach me, I've taught myself. I've gone into the forest and wrestled with the lion, and I didn't get this far by teaching one thing and doing another.
Yes!
Yeah.
Hey!
We should do a fave. I've got a fave here, which I love too, which is, when the scriptures melt away, the chants remain. When the chants melt away, the mind remains. When the mind melts away, what's left? A void mingles with the void.
The void mingles with the void.
It's great. Cosmic, man.
Oh. coming from the country that gave you zero.
Yes!
The void.
The void,
everything,
the void.
Nothing. Yeah.
Thank you so much for choosing this book and sharing this with us and sharing this with listeners. I also want to just quickly mention Ranjit Hoskote has a new book out from ARC of his own called The Atlas of Lost Beliefs, which came out in April. I never would have read had it not been for preparing for this episode.
Yeah.
Should we pull this to a close?
Yep.
Yeah. I think I hear the unstruck sound ringing out in the background, so we must pause. A huge thank you to Tishani for introducing us to this rich and relevant work, to Nikki Birch for harnessing our mind horses into something that resembles a gentle trot, and to Unbound for promising us the password to the supreme place.
You can currently download I Lala, The Poems of Lal Dad. It's available for Kindle. It seems to be quite hard to get hold of hard copies at the moment, but stick with it. John and I both have found copies and they're out there. So, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's really, really worth your, you know,
they're brilliant.
We don't step out. We don't step outside our comfort zones, so you don't have to. We don't. We do it, so it forces you to. So we thanks again to Shani for for helping us towards it. You can download all 118 previous episodes of Batlisted, plus follow links, clips, and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at batlisted.fm. We're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, or via our Patreon.
Show your love directly by supporting us. Patreon.com/backlisted. Your generosity helps buy us time. It's our sole source of income for doing the podcast. All patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early and for less than the price of a yoga session. Lot listeners get two extra lot listeds a month. The place where we three go to connect with the cosmic wholeness of the universe through sounds, words, and images.
NB may not have same benefits as yoga. Lock listeners also get to hear their names read out on the show as a mark of our thanks and appreciation. And this week's batch of Lock listener names are, John, you go first.
Sean Kemp, Melissa Fritz, Matthew Sullivan, Charlie Doyle, Jill Walters, Maureen Callahan-Wing, Ian Minto, Megan Othus, Malcolm Wright, Simon from Joya, Helen Ward, Jude Abbott, John Williams, Tracy Thompson, Darina Wade.
Emily Deaning, Jennifer Creedon, Kathleen Lee, Andrew Watson, Sharon Bainbridge, yay, Neil Siner, Graham Hiscock, Lynn Benson, Christopher Stewart, Dan Jenkins, the mysterious Sean, Zoe Lethbridge, Rupert Simons, and Jacob Crabb Peterson. Thank you so much, everybody, for supporting us, for making Backlisted possible.
Yes, and we will be back in a fortnight.
Choose to listen to Batlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/batlisted, where you also get bonus content of two episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.